Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
So as I said, we'll be in 2 Samuel chapter 8. I spent a lot of time going through 2 Samuel chapter 7. But that great promise that we looked at and we spent a lot of time on. Now we turn to chapter 8, which is really what we think about when we think about the narrative of kings, and especially when we're talking about kings and battles. These are the stories you want to read, especially as a young boy. They're the cool stories you want to turn to, maybe a young girl want to turn to in the Bible. But chapter 8, the title in my Bible is David's Victories. And in a way, that's the right title, but maybe it's the wrong title, as we'll see as we go through this. Although we've seen David as king for a long time, we've noted several times even about David's battles, and even notes such as the bunch of misfits that he had with the 600 men that joined him and that continued to be with him. We've seen how he has responded to people who have claimed to be friends of David by killing his enemies. By coming up, you know, the person who came up and told him about Saul's death and lied about Saul's death, the people that came up and told about Saul's son dying. But David really had separated himself from evildoers. And speaking of this, so chapter 8 comes familiar to us if we're familiar to the story of the kings, but it's quite different from what we've seen in 2 Samuel so far, and that'll come out clearly as we go through that. But we've seen a lot of conflict in the opening chapters of 2 Samuel, particularly between the house of David and the house of Saul. And chapter 8 comes up, and it moves the conflict outside the walls of within the country. But then you have chapter 9 there. We'll look at that next time we get together. But interesting how that is there, considering that it used to be internal. But now we see the political stretch of David's kingdom and his kingship, particularly after chapter 7 with this promise that after you lie down with your fathers, I'm going to raise up one of your sons to sit on your throne forever. But there are three major verbs which appear constantly throughout this passage. That's David defeated, David dedicated, and David reigned. David defeated, David dedicated, and David reigns. And that's what we'll be looking at this evening. The first is David defeated. In chapter 8, verses 1 to 3. After this, David defeated the Philistines and subdued them. And David took Metheg Ammah out of the hand of the Philistines and defeated Moab, and as he measured them with a line, making them lie down to the ground. Two lines he measured to be put to death, and one line he spared. And the Moabites became David's servants to David and brought tribute. David also defeated Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, the king of Zobah, as he went to restore the power at the river Euphrates. And David took from him 1,700 horsemen and 20,000 foot soldiers, and David hamstrung all the chariot horses, but left enough for 10 chariots. Now, I read past verse 3 there, just, I guess, getting too excited. But I like David defeated, but sometimes just the old King James is just you can't beat it. David smote the Philistines, and as David's king and his hand is outstretched, the other nations all around him pull back. The Philistines are one of the biggest enemies at this time. There's often, you know, many enemies that confront the Israelites, but often in that many enemies, there's one enemy in particular that rises up that's constantly at conflict with them. And the Philistines appear mainly in the time of the Judges, but they, as Judges progress, the Philistines become more and more consistent in their attack against the Israelites. And there's this rise during the period of Judges, as you remember in 1 Samuel, as we looked, it was the Philistines that took the Ark of the Covenant along. The glory of God has departed. And the Philistines constantly during this period, especially during David's reign, are the enemy that they're confronting during this time. But, and this is now a big part of this chapter, that he has defeated, how he has defeated in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 1. The king, we're told, lives in his house of cedar, but what had happened is the Lord had given him rest from all of his surrounding enemies. So as David comes to the throne, these enemies, which once were attacking them, now have taken a back foot, a step back. And now you see this battle begin again. And you've got to remember, this comes off the end of chapter 6 and chapter 7, those important chapters we spent a lot of time about. The chapter 6 is about worship of God correctly, but then also the promise of grace from God as well. So now, and we can't pass over this. You see, in Judges chapter 2, this is the cycle which begins during this time in the period of Judges. In Judges chapter 2, verses 11 to 15, "And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they abandoned the Lord and God, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. And they went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them. And they bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and served Baals and the Ashtaroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. He gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. He sold them into the hand of the surrounding enemies, so they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned, and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were in terrible distress." So underneath this time, the period of Judges, they see this rise where they go and serve other gods, worship and bow down. They follow, they disown, leave Yahweh, the one who has brought them out of Egypt, the one who has promised to Abraham, the covenant-keeping God. And here the Lord raises up enemies that surround them. And this is what happens in the period of Judges. The Lord raises up enemies to come in and conquer them. And during the period of David, we see a shift here. You might say that maybe you saw that shift in 1 Samuel underneath Samuel's judgeship in chapter 7, that great height of Israel finally putting away other gods and worshiping God. But now the Philistines are rising up, but then underneath David, they find rest. But in between the worship and the wars is chapter 7, that promise of grace through David's offspring. And we often pit works against faith, but they're connected. James says in James chapter 2, "But if anyone say, if you will say, you have faith and I have works, show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works." It is not that they are against each other. It's either faith or works. But faith always leads to faithful works. But never works leads to faith. Always faith precedes works. And find this. To find this balance is hard with children, right? When we often talk with Sarah about, we don't want to just raise little Pharisees. We don't just want to raise children that do the right thing externally and just obey what you say because you say it. What we want to do is have children that love Jesus, follow Jesus, and from their heart they seek to obey and glorify God. And there's a great difference between this. And as we look to David, we need to be reminded that David is a king after God's own heart. It's not that David was doing something right, therefore God gave him victory. It's always faith leads to faithful works. That David finds rest because of God's grace, but also because of his obedience to God's word, which comes from faith. And the nation of Israel can be seen by this external conflict and this internal conflict. Same with the church. That we can know that sometimes the church is dealing with internal conflict. Other times the church is dealing with external conflict. And we pray and we know that conflict will come. We know it will come from outside the church, for we are persecuted. But even Jesus says that when I go, there's going to be wolves that rise up. This is what Paul warns the elders as he's standing on the beach in Miletus, I think, in Acts chapter 20. He said, fierce wolves will rise up from within you. And here you see David, and he conquers his enemies. He smote the enemies. He defeated the long list of enemies, not just one, not just on one side, but across all the boundaries. Now, that's quite an accomplishment. It's quite an accomplishment for the strength of Israel at this time. Now, we might struggle with our Western ears to be able to hear passages like this. Now, we've discussed this a couple of times before. We need to be aware we live in a completely different time. The Western world can have problems, but one of the benefits of it is that we have laws. Even currently now, it doesn't take long to be able to turn on the news. And what do they talk about? Well, the Geneva Convention. They talk about NATO. They talk about all these laws and rules that we all try to be able to uphold. Laws that protect people, even for ourselves in this land. Laws that protect our things and ourselves. We have clear boundaries. We have big armies. And I heard this a couple of years, months ago, that we often think that the Western culture is not very culturally deep. It doesn't have a lot to be able to offer. It's shallow. We look to other cultures and we like their dance, their food, their music. The West, some people say, are boring, but this person was explaining that there's a rich difference in the Western culture. And one of these things is our understanding of justice and our justice systems. Often we downplay this. So we shouldn't come at passages like this with cultural snobbery, the measure of cultures via today's standards or expectations. I mean, even just current affairs. It doesn't take long for you to be able to talk to someone who might have said, war is never an option. But even today, you know, with another country and invading another country, people will say, well, of course they should fight. It changes once you have a situation. Now, we don't want to get too much, go too far down into that. But without going too off track, let's now turn back to the passage in verses 3 to 10. Thinking about David defeated Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, the king of Zorba, and he went to restore his power at the river Euphrates. And David took from him 1,700 horsemen and 20,000 foot soldiers, and David hamstrung all the chariot horses, but left enough for 100 chariots. When the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, the king of Zorba, David struck down 22,000 men from the Syrians, and David put garrisons in Aram of Damascus, and the Syrians became servants to David and brought tribute. And the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. David took the shields of gold that were carried by the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem from Betta and from Beroitai, the cities of Hadadezer. King David took very much bronze. When Toi, the king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated the whole army of Hadadezer, Toi sent his son Joram to King David to ask about his health and to bless him because he had fought against Hadadezer and defeated him, for Hadadezer had often been at war with Toi. And Joram brought with him the articles of silver and gold and bronze. Now, I think we can present three things in this passage that are surrounding that might be able to help us be able to understand this better. The first is restoration or restore. First, we're told that David went to restore his power at the river Euphrates. Now, this is not something to claim back something that was the nation of Israel. This is not a perfect argument, but I think it is something that we should at least consider. I often think if I was a politician, I don't think it's ever going to happen. I cannot. I can't be president, so what's the point? However, my philosophy would be quite simple. A nation should be led on a large scale as in a smaller scale. The same principles you apply in a small scale should apply on a large scale. How I would treat my house and run my house, I would transfer that onto a larger scale. Now, this might just be me as a simpleton thinking of this. But if someone started to move into my backyard and started setting up camp in my backyard and calling it theirs, even the most passive person would do something about it. Even confronting them, talking to them, they would try and do something about it. I would then, if they didn't respond, I would then probably take legal ramifications. You know, calling the police. You would not be called evil for taking action against this person who was living in your backyard. And so to here, I think this is what you see here. David is taking back where he was at the River Euphrates. He's seeking to be able to restore something that was theirs to begin with. And this is what you see here. In a larger view, on his backyard, there's people that have moved in. And then also, when you think about the earth is the Lord's and all the fullness thereof, that also has ramifications. The second thing you see is that he's at war with Hamath. Hadadezer was at war with Hamath in verse 10. Toi sent his son Joram to King David to ask about his health and to bless him because he had fought against Hadadezer and defeated him. Hadadezer had often been at war with Toi. Here comes a time when it's not even just protecting your own property is important. But what happens if someone's living in your neighbor's yard and your neighbor doesn't have the ability to deal with that person living in their yard, but you do? You have the ability to be able to go help. You might help them for your own safety, but even just to help the safety of your neighbor. Now, no country, to my knowledge, has ever declared war on Australia. But Australia has often, with other nations as allies, joined with them to be able to defeat the allies' enemies. Now, there was a similar thing to Pearl Harbor that happened at Darwin, but it was Australia has often joined together to defeat someone else who was at war. Now, we often think that these other nations are perfect and nice. Why would David go in and defeat them? But here you see that Hadadezer is going in and going to war with Toi, and frequently. Now, we can get more into theories of war and when it's right to be able to go into a war, if there's ever a just reason to be able to go to war. But often, these are not considered when discussing people, when people are discussing and closing the door to the Bible. They don't necessarily think about these topics. And is there ever a real right reason? And again, current affairs today, I think that most people would say that if someone comes into a nation and starts overpowering it, taking them to war, to say it's not right to be able to fight back, or other nations just standing back and just saying, well, you're on your own. There is a time when helping others, and we see those situations here in this passage. But those two things are valid and worth considering. However, we're told something else in the scripture that I think should help us understand this passage, and that's in verse 15. In verse 15, we're told, so David reigned over all Israel, and David administered justice and equity to his people. We've seen that David is a different type of king. He's not like Saul. A king does have power and the power of the sword. And we've seen that different from Saul. Saul had the power of the sword as king, but how did he use the sword? To be able to chase down David. Why did he chase down David? Not because David was at war with other people. Not because David was camping in his backyard and living and claiming, trying to overthrow him. though that might have been in his mind. We're told scripturally that Saul does it because of a little sin within him of jealousy. That Saul misused his power to be able to try and take this against himself. The kings can use the sword for power and vengeance to oppress others. But this says that David reigned and he administered justice and equity to all. That's what we see. David chose grace. But he also wisely, he did not follow rule with an iron fist. He used wisdom, such as the Ammonites, as we'll look in a couple of weeks in chapter 10. After the king of the Ammonites died, and Hanun, the son, reigned in his place, David said, "I will deal loyally with Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father dealt loyally with me." So David sent his servants to console him concerning his father, and David's servants came into the land of the Ammonites. But you see, he's not just going out, going to war because he's got some vendetta against the surrounding nations. He's going to war, one, to protect his boundaries, one, to be able to help others that are around him. But also, we're told that he does so with justice as well. So we see David defeated. The next thing we see is David dedicated. We'll begin with verses 11 and 12. He's also, King David, dedicated to the Lord, together with the silver and gold that he dedicated from all the nations he subdued, from Edom to Moab to the Ammonites, the Philistines, Amalek, and the spoil of Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, the king of Zorba. Many nations gave David tribute and looked to David, but we see here that David has this attitude of gratefulness towards God. We see once more, worship of God is important to David. It's not merely that he worships God to be able to get things. And we'll come back to this. But again, it's important when we think about the other nations he defeated, better maybe subdued, they rise up again, they come back. David didn't fight with the Ammonites. We're told in chapter 10 that he tried to seek to work out an agreement with them, as mentioned before with verses 1 and 2. But from the surrounding areas, you look back at these period of Judges, these names are quite common. They come up frequently throughout the pages of Judges. And this is quite a political feat, an accomplishment for the kingdom of God. And verses 13 and 14 fit underneath the first heading. And David made himself, when he returned from striking down 18,000 Edomites from the Valley of Salt, and he put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all Edom, he put garrisons, and the Edomites became David's servants, and the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. We'll look at this next week when we, just a passing comment, but we find out in Psalm 60, as we'll discuss next week, this was actually quite a difficult battle. It's interesting here, if you read these pages, it just seemed like he just went there and struck down these Edomites. It was just an easy task. But the title of Psalm chapter 60, a maxim of David for instruction when he strove at Aram Naharim at Aram Zorba, and went when Joab, on his return, struck down 12,000 of Edom in the Valley of Salt. We'll look at this next week. But the last thing that we see in this passage, not only that David defeated, David dedicated, but also David reigned. And we see this in the verses 15 to 18. So David reigned over all Israel. And David administered justice and equity to all his people, Joab the son of Zeruiah, and all over the army, and Jehoshaphat the son of Ahilud was recorder, and Zadok the son of Ahitab, and Ahimelech the son of Abathar were priests, and Sarai was secretary, and Benaiah and the son of Jehoiada was over the Cherethites and the Paliites, and David's sons were priests. Although we cannot say this speaks exclusively of David, per se, in his reign, the others fit into this category. The author of Hebrews explains that this is all done through faith. He explains that, what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, the son of David, and Samuel, and of the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, and were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Now, you could say in all these that besides maybe quenching the power of fire, all of these other things could be said of David. And we're told that he does all of these things through faith. We're told that he does all of these things through faith. It wasn't merely just for political gain. But we miss, if we just look at political gain, what it turns into is works. But faith precedes works. We also see this as a shadow of Christ's kingdom. 2 Samuel chapter 23. And God of Israel had spoken, the Rock of Israel had said to me, when one rules justly over men, ruling in the fear of God. A promise of Christ to come who rules justly and with equity for all. But we also see that David is not alone in this. He doesn't merely just do this single-handedly, but he has people that surround him. Joab, which we'll look at in a couple of weeks, over the army. Jehoshaphat, a recorder. And then these others as well, the priests, the secretary. David's sons were priests. Joab plays a very important part in David's life. Jehoshaphat was a recorder. Now, have you ever wondered how you know how many horse chariots they defeated? How many men they killed? Well, it's this guy's job to count them, to record it. Now, this may be an argument why presbyteries have clerks to record numbers. You've got to be like Jehoshaphat. Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abathai, were priests. Now, Ahimelech was the one that Saul told Doeg the Edomite to destroy at Nob. And his son, Abathar, was Ahimelech's son who fled to David. David took him in, and now his son, Zadok, is his priest. You see another secretary, Siahira, the secretary again. Another argument for clerks. But you have here other people as well. Now, just briefly, that last comment, that David's sons were priests. Now, it's an interesting comment. David's sons are not Israelites, so they should not be serving in the temple. And sometimes it does appear that David might blur the lines between the kingship and the priesthood. Now, it sometimes might appear that way. I think the simple argument is that just because David said that offered sacrifices doesn't mean he doesn't use a priest to be able to do that. And so too here, because the big issue with Saul was Saul disobeyed and Saul overstepped his boundaries as king, and he began to offer sacrifices. So he overstood his bounds as king, and he started doing priestly duties. So it's strange that David would be able to do that without any consequence, but that's the reason why Samuel told Saul that I'd rather obedience rather than sacrifice. That's one of the big things in chapter 6 when the ark, and they touch the ark. But I think there's a few notes. Some people might say that it says they served as priests, and it's just wrong. Now, that's a simple argument. I don't really take much for that. But it's possible that they served. They oversaw the temple, but they didn't actually do the performances, do the sacrifices of a priest. They looked after the temple. That was kind of their responsibilities, so that they could have served in an administration role. The other is that they served in the temple, but they didn't carry anything out. They were helping where possible, but they weren't doing the duties that were set apart for actually making sacrifices and things like that. We're not told particularly about that. I have this note about that I was confused at some point. I was very in 2 Samuel chapter 20, verses 23 to verse 6, it explains a similar thing of what's happening here. Recorders and secretaries, they served as priests. And it said Ira, the Jarite, was also David's priest. And then I had typed in the wrong verse from 2 Samuel chapter 20, verse 2 to 3. And I was quite confused about what that was about, but I worked it out. But in 1 Chronicles chapter 18, we're told that that David's sons were the chief officials in the service of the king. So we're told that information that here might give us a little bit clarity how it says that they served as priests. Here it says that they're, David's sons were chief officials in the service of the king. Now, in all of this, we see David defeating, David reigning, David dedicating. You call this chapter David's victories. And I think there's an aspect to that which is accurate. But I think maybe they're missing something in that title. It should be David's victories through God. You know, David's victory as he's been used by God or something. Maybe a little bit more cumbersome. But David does dominate this passage. But you got to ask the question, why would David dedicate the spoils to the Lord? In verse 6, we're told David put garrisons around Aram of Damascus, and the Syrians became servants of David and brought tribute. But then we're told at the end of this passage that, and the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. Same in verse 14. He put garrisons in Edom. Throughout Edom, he put all garrisons, and all the Edomites became David's servants. And the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. Back to this idea that we saw right when we met David, when he was defeating Goliath. It's only because of the Lord's outstretched hand that David sees any success. David is a no one, a no name. And God pulls this shepherd from the sheepfold, anoints him as king. Abraham is a nobody in the land of Haran. David appears to him and says, I will make your name great. David is merely the agent God uses. That's exactly what Hannah's prayer is about in chapter 2 of 1 Samuel. That my horn is exalted, my mouth derides my enemies, because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none like holy like the Lord, for there is none besides you. There is no rock like our God. And towards the end, the adversaries of the Lord shall be broken into pieces. When them he shall thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth, and he will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. That here you see David's victories only come because the Lord is granting them to him. We should be reminded, as we should always be thinking, this is always just a shadow of a glorious picture to come. This is a child-like picture. The one that you put on a fridge, right, of a house. You know what it looks like. It looks like a house. But this is merely but just a shadow compared to a piece of artwork of Christ's kingdom to come. Isaiah, that Christmas verse that's stolen, right? That only appears at Christmas time. But this is true all the time. In Isaiah chapter 9, "For unto us a child is born, a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. For the increase of his government and peace there will be no end, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish and uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. And the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this." And here you see just this, but like a shadow, that David defeats, but Christ defeats Satan, sin and death. David dedicates. But here Christ goes and ascends to heaven and gives gifts to his church. And David reigns with justice and equity for all, but Christ reigns over all the earth, not merely just a geographical place, just but a shadow of Christ's kingdom. What a glorious image that is.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.